My name is Hadley Rees, and people describe me as a 40-year veteran of the pharmaceutical industry. And I specialize in the regulations and supply chain management in biopharmaceutical supply chains. So my skill set is really understanding each stage of manufacture and development of biologics products, which would be a vaccine or a monoclonal antibody or something like that. Very challenging supply chain. And I was well known in the industry before I was kicked off LinkedIn. And I've basically been cut out ever since. So I've written numbers of books about the modus operandi of the industry, which was is really cavalier towards its supply chains. One of those being Taming the Big Pharma Monster, and you have interviewed me on that previously, Tony. And what's happened now with these injections is unbelievable, because they've thrown the rule book out and they just, you know, don't care if they kill people. And I've been very vocal in this, and I'm just about to write or submit my manuscript to Wiley for my next book, which is called Transforming the Pharmaceutical Supply Chain, which will reveal... It will reveal all. So,
before we get too deep into that, I can remember during the COVID crisis that we had over in the United States a massive write-off of a massive batch of COVID vaccines because they'd found something in there which wasn't supposed to be in there. Now, this is exactly your sort of territory. Can you tell us what happened there?
Yeah, well, it's basically, these are so easy to contaminate, these products. They're supposed to be sterile. Now, I say that again, they're supposed to be sterile. And when those injections were shipped into the vaccination centers, they could never have been sterile because they were just handled by people who'd never worked in the supply chain before. So the contravention of regulations there was absolutely extreme. And how these vaccines are made, they go through different stages in different parts of the world. So they start off with what's known as a cell line, a starting material, which is animal cells. And those then are shipped by air, frozen down to minus 192 degrees C to the manufacturer that makes the drug substance. Now, this is the active substance that goes into the patient's body. And that company has to do the genetic modification of the cells. And when it's finished doing that, and that takes about 2 months probably, they ship that to the next stage in another part of the world where they do the fill finish, which means they fill the liquid into the vials, they put a rubber stopper on top and an aluminium seal, and that then goes to the next stage. Now, normally the next stage would be to go into a carton, and just one vial would go into the carton and would go into the distribution system to wholesalers, and that would then go to a doctor. So what the doctor would receive is just one vial in one carton, and you'd either draw out that single dose or it would be in a pre-filled syringe, so he wouldn't have to do anything. So it's unprecedented ever for people to have to finish off vaccines themselves. And that was an immediate red flag. And I wrote to the European Medicines Agency at the time and said, this is ridiculous. And I got the usual, well, you know, look at this website and I'm sure you'd be happy. It's all fine. So
how do you mean they have to finish them off themselves?
So many people were part of this. When the instructions for the frozen injection, this is the Moderna and the Pfizer BioNTech vaccine, but people have to receive a trays of 195 vials. When I say people, I mean in the vaccination centers. These were willing volunteers, people wanting to help, people in hospitals. They had to receive these 195 vials frozen down to either minus 70 or minus 20 degrees C. They had to thaw them. Now, thawing is a very critical manufacturing activity, because it's like when you take something out of your freezer, it could taste differently to what it tasted like when you put it in there. So you have to make sure that what you started with, you've still got when it's at room temperature or refrigerated temperature. Now, that is a crucial manufacturing operation, and it was done under uncontrolled conditions. Then the people there had to introduce saline diluent into the vial, and they had to turn that over 10 times to mix it up. Now, again, mixing is crucial because you can get hot spots. You have to make sure that the liquid is homogeneously distributed throughout the vial, and you do that by testing after you've done the insertion of the saline diluent. And then, of course, it went straight into patients' arms with no quality control testing or anything. It was ludicrous. And
I understand what you're saying. You're saying that the nurse, whoever it is that applies the actual injection, is actually part of the manufacturing process. This is not, you're quite right, that is not normal. Can you just say something about these mRNA vaccines? We know that the Pfizer and the Moderna ones were mRNA type vaccines, but I don't think it's quite so clear about the AstraZeneca one. Can you just give us an idea of the differences between these different vaccines? And it's almost like it was a kind of pick and mix down at Woolworths. You know, you pick whichever one you want. You can have that one or not that one if you want. But what was the difference between them?
Well, the AstraZeneca vaccine was known as an adenovirus vaccine. There's two methods, the mRNA, which people talk about. But the other method is to use a virus to deliver the modified cell into the patient's body. When a virus goes into your body, it replicates its own DNA, which makes you ill. But if you change the virus's DNA, when it goes into your body, it replicates that new DNA. So that's the way the AstraZeneca vaccine works. Now, the company that made the AstraZeneca injections is a company called Oxford Biomedica, based in Cowley in Oxford. I spent 6 months there in 2013 working with them on a UK government grant for a drug that subsequently Novartis launched, gene therapy drug called Kymriah. Now, the side effects on that drug after launch are horrific. And they're basically cytokine storm and neurological toxicities. So not too dissimilar to the side effects that we're seeing with the AstraZeneca vaccine, because Oxford Biomedica also makes the AstraZeneca drug substance, the active ingredient. Now, people don't realize that. When people in Wimbledon clap in Sarah Gilbert for developing the AstraZeneca vaccine, that was complete nonsense. And AstraZeneca has never developed a biologic product in its life. So all these vaccines have been manufactured by contractors, and they get paid no matter what. If the drug fails, they get paid, because the contract they sign with the big pharma companies absolves them of any responsibility for anything going wrong in the work. So almost by definition, you've got a big issue there, that the companies making the drugs are not the ones selling them. But the main thing to say was, in 2013, when I was in Oxford Biomedica, the technology was very experimental, very early day. And I just thought that the MHRA would say, I know this, it's the 2020 now, but they're still experimental. We still haven't cracked the immense supply chain challenges with these biologics. But hey ho, they waved them through.
Okay, so what you seem to be saying, Edley, is that this was a technology which was bubbling away, that the pharmaceutical industry was having trouble getting it approved. And so, in a way, COVID coming along was, basically like a hero on the horizon And it allowed the changing of the rules to make this technology that they'd spent quite a lot of money developing legal, whereas previously it hadn't been allowed.
Absolutely. That's absolutely right, Tony.
So tell us a bit about AstraZeneca and Oxford University. Having worked there, they're an interesting, they were a major part of the whole vaccine rollout, weren't they?
Oh, they were, but what people don't realize is very little science involved in making these injections. The supply chain is what the supply chain produces is what the patient gets in their arm. So all this talk about follow the science, that's a load of nonsense. If you went to the Oxford Biomedical site, you'd see machinery there, you'd see engineers, you'd see, you know, manufacturing people. Some of them are scientifically qualified, but you don't have to be scientifically qualified. You know, if building an aircraft has got about the same amount of science into it as developing and manufacturing a drug, because fundamentally, you've got to put stuff together, you've got to use raw materials, components, all those things, put them together to get that product into the market. So that is why the whole warp speed is such a nonsense, because, you know, and particularly it's more safety critical than an aircraft with these drugs. So and people don't realize that.
Another Welshman, Jamie Jenkins, has been quite prolific, hasn't he, talking about the side effects of these jabs.
No, I've been very, very clear on this all along, that I don't need to follow the statistics. I don't need to look at the data. If you cobbled an aircraft together in 12 months, that should have taken 10 years, that aircraft is going to crash. Yeah, I guarantee. The same with a car. The fundamental issue here is that they've done nothing other than clinical studies on these drugs. They haven't done any of the safety studies where, you know, which normally take 3 years just to make sure that you can go into humans. It normally takes 7 years to go through the clinical trials, and it takes about 18 months for the regulator to assess all the data and make the approval. You know, that is documented. So I knew instantly that people were going to die. That's what frustrates me in a sense, because if people realized what was involved in making these drugs, they'd instantly say, we need the manufacturers on site there explaining what's gone wrong. And so I'm not very good at statistics either, but for this, you don't need it.
AstraZeneca, if they were on the line, they would say, well, we threw the sold the farm for this one. We know we got loads of extra people involved, and we just speeded the whole process that would have taken a couple of years. We just made sure that it was able to take place quickly because we threw loads of resources at it.
Well, you can't throw money at things and make them happen quicker, can you? You know, there are certain activities that have to take place. If you put any more people into it, you'd have too many cooks spoiling the broth. You know, the number of people that should be making these drugs will have been there all along. And if they weren't there, there was something wrong with the company. So, you know, you cannot throw money at something like this and do it more quickly. I can't think of an analogy at the moment. But, you know, believe me, money would not have speeded this up at all. And that what you described there, Tony, is just one of the usual propaganda psychopop stories that they make up to, you know, con people into believing this is all being kosher.
Okay, well, look, what about Glaxo? Because their role, GSK, this is GlaxoSmithKline. I'm not sure what the origin of them are, because it sounds to me like lots of pharmaceutical industry companies over the years merging. But I know they were actually behind the scenes. They were really the people that ran the COVID vaccine rollout, weren't they?
Absolutely. After Kate Bingham, who was the initial chair of the vaccine task force in the UK, reported to Boris Johnson, Sir Richard Sykes took over the chair in 2020-21, And he was the CEO of Glaxo, which was the forerunner to Glaxo Welcome, which was the forerunner to GlaxoSmithKline. And Sir Richard Syke masterminded those two mega mergers. And he was the chair of the vaccine task force. Working with him was Sir Ian McCubbin, who was, again, a long-term VP of supply chain for GSK. I met him in 2012. And between those two and another GSK board member in the US, a guy called Sal Wee, forget his first name, a 30-year employee of GSK, he was advisor to Donald Trump on the Warp Speed project. So you had GSK executives actually masterminding the entire global rollout of the vaccines. MHRA, the former CEO of MHRA before Jim Rain was a guy called Dr. Ian Hudson, and he joined the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation in 2019. So he is effectively running MHRA even today. And Bill Gates obviously is working behind the scenes with UK government. We're getting them excited about what these vaccines can do for the UK. UK government have had, they want to be number one in life sciences in the world. And they've been working on this since the year 2001, when the UK government started meetings with big pharma companies. Sir Richard Sykes was at the first meeting in 2021. And ever since, they've been working together in a you help me and I'll help you. So the UK government has been wanting the pharmaceutical industry to make it number one in life sciences, so that it can prove that, we're a major force in the world.
Okay, so, it sounds like a bit of a tug of war going on. So you've got the pharmaceutical industry being courted by government. So the government is supposed to be there representing the patients, people who are ultimately going to have these drugs. And yet it seems that, in a way, they are doffing the cap of the public to the pharmaceutical industry because they're desperate to have a very, very successful biotech industry.
Absolutely. You've summarized that superbly.
So you mentioned, I think, was it Welcome there?
What? Oh, the Welcome Trust and Jeremy Farrar.
Yeah, because, didn't you say that GSK were originally partly part of Welcome?
Yeah, the way they actually bought, they were Glaxo. Glaxo started as a company making milk powders, and they moved more into pharmaceuticals, and there was a separate company called Welcome, and Glaxo acquired Welcome in the late 1980s.
The reason I mentioned Wellcome Trust is because I've got a personal interest. We used to go, I went to school, at my secondary school, and it was a grammar school, was Langley Park in southeast London near Beckenham in Kent, West Wickham area. Mm-hmm. And that next door to our school was a great big place called Langley Court, which was then known as Burroughs Wellcome, which was the research headquarters for something called the Wellcome Trust. That's spelt with two L's, by the way, yeah. Double L. And yeah. As school kids, when we were sort of 13, 14 years old, we used to joke in the on the school playing field when we were out messing around at lunchtime about the cows with two heads next door, And in fact, there was a big tower, like a giant water tower, and a chimney next to this beautiful old country house, very incongruous, actually, see the giant water tower and the chimney. And at school, we used to joke that when they created some sort of genetic monstrosity in there, that they would first of all try and flush it down the drain using the giant water tower. And if it wouldn't go down the drain, they'd stick it in the incinerator and burn it in the chimney. And we also used to point at the chimney sometimes when you see smoke coming out. So that was right next door to where I went to secondary school. And the Wellcome Trust seems to me very similar to this thing in the United States, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. So, you know, these kind of so-called charitable foundations in the States are similar to the charitable trust in Britain, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah. And we know the head of Wellcome Trust had just moved to be chief scientific officer at the World Health Organization. So how about that for revolving doors?
I mean, he was Jeremy Farrar was in charge of SAGE, I think, wasn't it? Over here?
Initially he was on SAGE, and then, you know, and the thing is, they're working behind the scenes, even if you're not seeing them on committees. They may duck and dive, but they're working behind the scenes. And I've got documentation that says that SAGE was meeting with the pharmaceutical manufacturers in 2015. So
interesting, isn't it, that they don't really need to meet with them. They are them.
Yes, I suppose you could say that.
I mean, yeah. What about the MHRA? Because they're supposed to regulate all this. We saw June Rain with her kind of slightly twisted smile approving these vaccines, saying they're all fantastic. Well, we know that they've been involved in various scandals. One of the most recent ones was the mesh, which has been implanted in mostly into women and also some into men as well, which turned out to be a complete and utter disaster. And yet that was all approved by the MHRA.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a shell organization. The evaluation of new drugs moved to the European Medicines Agency in 1995. So MHRA has never evaluated the drug application ever since. They don't have the skills. What they're doing is just pretending that they do have the skills and just waving these things through. The number of freedom of information requests that have gone into MHRA, you could paper, you know, 1,000 walls with. It's unbelievable. But so, and I attended an MHRA symposium. Kindly UK column paid me to do that, on good distribution practice, and it was horrific. And I've recorded these as well. They were saying that they suspended quality control during the vaccines being developed and produced by adopting what they call shipping under quarantine. Now that means you can ship from one manufacturer to the next, even though it hadn't been quality controlled. So the shipping site hadn't quality controlled it. Now the idea would be that when the other company gets it, they hold it until they've been informed that it has been passed, and then they can release it. But of course, these companies don't talk to each other. The chance of them holding it would have been, you know, zilch. So effectively, these materials are going all over the world with no quality control. And I was listening to what they were saying, you know, and I co-chaired a conference in Cincinnati from 2011 to 2014, which was FDA co-sponsored, and MHRA speakers, we had them every year, and they were good quality, you know, inspectors and senior managers. Now, they're just kids there. They're just youngsters, or, you know, the people who decided to stay on and just, you know, take the money, if you like.
Well, it sounds to me like the media studies CSE students you get on the BBC today, Lee. Can you just say something about the role of things like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and the Wellcome Trust, though? Because, I mean, they're slightly separate to the industry itself. They are these charitable foundations, but they've also made a lot of money out of this. They're supposed to be charities, but one questions what their charity, whether they've really got proper charitable aims.
In 2011, Bill and Melinda Gates employed a guy called Trevor Mundell, who was the head of R&D for Novartis in Switzerland. Now, Novartis, the company I mentioned, that launched the first gene therapy for blood cancers in the US. It was approved by FDA in 2017. Now, so Mundell has been working since 2011 with Bill and Melinda Gates to just get gene therapies integrated into the whole narrative about the future of health and people and that whole thing. Now,
okay, does it work? This gene therapy, does it actually work?
Oh, no, no. Well, the FDA have just, the only gene therapy that's out there at the moment is what they call a CAR T therapy, which is for rare blood cancers. And the FDA have just put a warning. There's six on the market, and the FDA made them all put a severe warning on the labeling to say this can cause, it can cause, neurological toxicities, cytokine release syndrome, and all sorts of other things. So FDA always was the gold standard in regulatory. And what's happened is the CDC and Bill Gates and those have sidelined the FDA over this period, so that, and the guy at FDA, a guy called Peter Marks, is the head of all the approvals of the biologics drugs. And Peter Marks has just given evidence in Congress in the US, and he's had difficulty answering the questions there. So I think that is, people are waking up at FDA, and they are now really beginning to stamp their authority on this. So they put these warnings on these CAR-T therapies, which means gene therapies are not going to sell, basically because they can kill people.
Well, I don't know. Like, sometimes people don't actually read the warnings. And I do wonder whether there is this kind of high-tech route that's that many of the pharmaceutical industries are going to go down, because they get paid so much more for this high-tech stuff than they do for basic stuff like aspirins. And one, you know, fascinating drug which has come out over the COVID period is this stuff ivermectin, which is very simple, seems to do a lot better than these much more expensive, complicated drugs.
Oh, yeah. Ivermectin has been generic for 20 years or more. I've had clients who make it, you know, very, very good. But this was the narrative, wasn't it? They were pushing remdesivir, and they were trying to stop any therapies. But what I was going to say, I forgot what I was going to say now, but yes, hydrochloroquine, ivermectin, you've got people like Dr. Pierre Corey, you know, an eminent doctor who said, I'm treating patients and ivermectin works, you know, no doubt about it. But I know in the UK, you know, the pharmacists were not allowed to prescribe ivermectin. So a lot of this comes back to the UK being central to this whole global activity. And what frustrates me is that there's, in the US, there's all this hubbub about depopulation and the, you know, I don't buy that, because if you look at the people actually doing this, they don't want to kill their customers. They don't want to depopulate the world. Maybe the, you know, the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds and all those billionaires want to, but the people who are actually doing it are doing it for money and kudos and knighthoods.
And, well, I mean, it's also for your career, isn't it? I mean, you go along with the groupthink if you want to get a good career. But also, look, I know you also wanted to mention Imperial College and their role. Because we know, I mean, I'm a little bit suspicious about King Charles, especially since the death of the lovely Princess Diana. Very, very, you know, and now, of course, he's King Charles, and he's now got cancer. So I wonder whether this cancer, well, at least he says he has, you know, maybe it's misdiagnosed, as a lot of cancers are. Even personal friends of mine have had misdiagnoses of cancer. And there seems to be a deliberate attempt to muddy the waters, you know. So what about Imperial College's role in this new mRNA cancer vaccine?
Right. Well, I've got to go back to 2022, when the MHRA, the only regulator in the world, changed the regulations so that hospital pharmacies could actually manufacture mRNA injections. Now, I wrote a letter to Dr. Laura Squire, who's second in command at MHRA, and she came back and she said, I've got the letter. Oh, it's all okay. She said, we're still working on it, but it's all fine. Now, so what they want to do is do exactly the same as they did with the COVID injections. They want to ship frozen vials into hospitals and do the final finishing. So, and Imperial College is the first hospital now to actually do that. and they say they're developing mRNA for cancer. Now, solid tumours in cancers, no one's made any impact on that ever. You know, no one ever thought about using any sort of therapy that could attack solid cancer tumours. So this is a fabrication. It's an absolute fabrication. And the plan is in UK, they're going to do this in more and more hospitals. And they're hoping that they will, you know, a typical CAR T therapy will cost nearly $500,000. So, you know, you say this isn't about money, and it's not going to work. That's the thing. I don't know if that makes sense, Tony, or not, but.
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously it is about the money, isn't it? It's one of the main reasons. But I don't know, what makes you think, well, what's the motive here then? You know, if someone goes to their GP, they say they've got a pain somewhere, it comes back, they do a blood test, they say, oh, it's cancer, and they go for one of these mRNA cancer tests, what chance is there of it curing them?
None whatsoever. But the thing is, anyone who came along in the world and said, I've got a cure for cancer, you know, people would be bashing their door down. So they're saying they've got a cure for cancer. People, they're bashing their door down, but they haven't got a cure for cancer.
What's the evidence for it?
What, to say that they work?
Yeah.
There's no evidence. I'm going through this now. I'm going through the development of these CAR T therapies. They started in 1960, and scientists, there's only one or two scientists have been claiming, oh, this killed cancer cells in mice. Oh, God, we've got to do more of this. There's only about two or three scientists, and they've created this narrative over 50 years now, nearly 60 years, saying, you know, these things are going to work. And if you look at the drugs that come to market now in pharmaceuticals, there's no new drugs. You know, we've still got antimicrobial resistance, and penicillin came to market in 1945. And we haven't really seen any better antibiotics than penicillin. You know, we've got antacids that the industry have launched. We've got these things for indigestion. But what really is the global pharmaceutical industry bringing to the world? They bring in gene therapies. Well,
yeah, that's a new type. Well, look, what would you say to people who are interested in preserving their own natural immune system? Because that's another way you can make yourself healthy.
Oh, yeah. Well, functional medicines, you know, are vitamins and minerals, basically. You know, that's Mother Nature's pharmaceutical product. And the level, you know, we should be people should be screened for levels of, you know, their vitamins and minerals, because they can be far more powerful, have a far more powerful effect on the body than the sort we take a medicine. We don't really know if we, you know, what it's going to do to us. Well, as we know, if you're taking vitamins and minerals, so long as they've been produced properly, nature's going to, you know, make good use of them.
What about things like chemotherapy and radiotherapy for cancer? Because that's got a bit more of a proven route than this mRNA.
Well, you know, I think the jury's out on that, isn't it? The people developing the evidence are not always wholly independent. So I think that there's no definitive evidence on the extent to which these work for different conditions. You know, there's maybe 200 different types of cancer, so, you know, it's all a bit hit and miss, the whole thing, as far as I can see anyway. I mean, I'm not a doctor, so I can't say too much, but, you know, I do read the papers and I do my research. And
anyone that's interested in finding out a bit more about this so-called mRNA cancer vaccine, are there any good reports on it that you've seen?
Let me think. I've got the one, the Imperial College one. Can I get back to you with that, or do you need to know?
Yeah, of course, but I mean, you're pointing out is that one's flawed. you know.
Oh, yes.
Imperial College are really talking it up, almost like they're a bunch of used car salesmen, you know. But I mean, if people are interested in reading more about the doubts over this mRNA cancer vaccine, anywhere they can go? Have you got a website? Have you got
Website? Well, they could look at my website, Inside Pharma, has got two or three years worth of evidence of all the things I've said here, cast iron evidence, website links, you know, and I every day just about I update with what's happening next.
You better spell out the website, because you know what, these Google algorithms make the really good websites very difficult to find.
All right. So it's Inside as a gap pharma, two separate words, Inside Pharma. I don't know. I started it in 2022, or was it 21? I can't remember. But January 2022. I've got 6,000 subscribers. I haven't got many paid ones, but people are very interested in it. So, it's worth looking at. And thanks for mentioning that, Tony.
Yeah, just give us the website again. Is this two separate words just run into one? Is it as usual? And have you got an org.uk or something on the end?
With a Substack, it's just got... If someone were to go...
I see. InsidePharma.substack.com then. That will work to be what it is.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
Okay, Hedley Rees, fascinating chat. I wonder if you could just round off by saying, I think the one thing that I think what we can definitely agree on is that you've got a whole industry out there now preying on people's fears for their health, trying to make money out of it. And not really caring what goes into their arms, so long as they get their kickbacks. It's almost like a kind of mafia system, really. But with basic stuff like ivermectin, chloroquine, is it possible to get hold of these drugs? Will your doctor prescribe them if you ask them? And if not, how do you get them?
Well, doctors can prescribe what they call off-label. Normally, a drug is approved for what they call the indication, the disease. So if you haven't got the disease, the doctor can't say it's licensed to be used in that disease or that indication. The problem with ivermectin was it wasn't licensed to be used in something like whatever COVID-19 was.
Well, it was an antiviral, yeah.
It's got numbers of uses. A client of mine in Bulgaria, excellent client. I worked with them to see if we could get it registered in the UK, but MHRA just did not want to know. So one of the things is that doctors have not been prescribing off-label because behind the scenes, I'm sure, you know, through the various health systems, they've been told not to do it because, it's going to affect the sales for the injections.
Well, I know the French government in January 2020 commandeered all supplies of French ivermectin. So they were even ahead of the game when it came to people dying of COVID. They wanted to make sure that the French government had all of the supplies of the ivermectin, and the public weren't going to be able to get any of them. So, you know, this just shows you that there are some people out there, anyway, playing games with us, aren't they, Hedley?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I would say about ivermectin, the risk as well is if people start buying off the internet from rogue sources. So that was also a risk going on. But I just finish off, Tony, by saying this industry has been going downhill for the last four decades. So in the mid-1980s, the big pharma companies outsourced all their physical assets, all their manufacturing plants, all their distribution capability. And so all it's been doing ever since is what they call discovery research, which is patenting or patenting molecules, and sales and marketing. They don't own anything in between, so they have been unable to bring products to market. And this is where we are today, because this COVID was last chance saloon for Big Pharma to deliver the blockbuster profits that it had become so used to delivering using sales and marketing muscle. And, you know, this is the result of it. And there is a way back, but it's going to need governments to change patent law, patent law, so that they cannot game the patent system by just saying, that's my molecule, you, no one else can use it, and if it gets to market, I can make it into a blockbuster. That is at the bottom of all of this.
Okay, Hedley, just remind us of your Substack again.
Yeah, it's called Inside Pharma, and that's all I can say. It's on Substack.
Okay, Hedley Rees, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Tony. Really appreciate you asking me to be here.